Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, have you finished your taxes? Probably not for many of you listening today. Oh, boy. The deadline's coming up. It was less than a month away. And who better to help us out with all that than Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon and Tax Professionals. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business a long time, more than 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars around the country. And Mary, if you've heard her before, you know that she is very knowledgeable about taxes. And if you have a question for her, I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome, Larry.
This got to be, as a tax preparer, let's put it that way. How busy is this time of the year for you?
Crazy busy. It's only time to do this and sleep. Throw a little food in once in a while.
When do you think it's too late to hire a tax professional?
It's never late to hire one. However, at this time of the year, that might mean that you're willing to file an extension on April 15th and have the work done later.
It makes sense. How do you find somebody like yourself? How do you find a reliable person to file your taxes for you?
I think the best way is word of mouth. Finding someone who likes their tax professional and referring them. And you hope that that person that's being referred to is still taking clients, because sometimes that's an issue as well. But beyond that, there are professional organizations that have a listing of people, as well as at the IRS website. You can look for a list of people. At the IRS, will do it based on people who are enrolled agents or people who have a designation called annual filing season record of completion individuals. And both of those in the tax world mean that people are up to date on the latest tax issues, that they're required to take a certain number of credit hours per year to keep up. And that's probably what you're looking for, especially if you have a tax issue that is over and above it. You're looking for someone who is up to date, who is knowledgeable, and knows what's going on.
If you're going to fill your own out, for a lot of people, maybe it's a fairly simple job, and there's still time to do that, at least. But what's the basic form? 1040A, I suppose.
There is no 1040A anymore, Larry.
Well, see, now that shows how much I know.
And you're only about 7 years behind that. But the 1040 is the form.
1040.
The only variation to the 1040 for an individual who is a U.S. citizen or resident alien, it's the 1040. There is a 1040 SR, which is just like SR meaning senior, that was created maybe 5 years ago, that is just a bigger print form. It's the same form. It just takes 3 pages to look at it instead of 2.
Could I go to the IRS, get the form from the 1040 form, and maybe that's the only one I need? Could I fill it out online and just send it back to them?
IRS doesn't have a program that allows you to do that. They created at a very high cost a program that the IRS had. And I mean a very high cost. And the last tax bill said, nope, you can't do that, stop. But what IRS has done is make arrangements with certain software companies that you can go to the IRS website and look for a software company. And the software companies sometimes will do the tax returns for free depending on income levels. Or you can use those software through that direction to file a tax return on your own. The only thing I would caution people is be sure you read carefully. I don't know exactly how they work, but I understand that sometimes you have a hard time going back to look at the form to make sure what you want to happen happened. And like I say, I don't have it. And the other thing that I have found with people who use online software, sometimes they forget to print or save a copy of the return after they filed it. And so if you don't save a copy and you need it for something, it's difficult to go back and get it, or you go to the IRS and pay money to have a copy sent to you from the IRS.
Oh, so make sure you make a copy.
Correct.
Oh, makes a lot of sense. Well, I have many more questions, but there are also many listeners with questions, too. So we should probably take some right now. Bob in Fond du Lac has a question about Wisconsin income tax, I think. Let's go there. Bob, hi.
Hi. I received a refund on my state taxes. And this is for an audit that was done on 2021 state taxes. And my question has to do with from what I figured out, I do not have to report that on Schedule 1 for my federal 1040. It seems that I need to look at a publication 525. Or something like that to put that refund on from another year. I should also note that I did not itemize deductions in any of those years from 21 to now.
Okay. First of all, can I ask a question about your 21 refund? Did it have anything to do with retirement income?
No.
Okay.
No.
Good. Thanks for the answer. As far as the state refund is never taxable to the federal unless you itemize. And the only reason it's taxable when you itemize is if you took a state deduction claiming higher income and you got some of that income, that state tax back, that's why you have to pick it up. So if you did not have to pick it up, I mean, if you did not itemize, then you have no responsibility of picking up that state refund on your federal return.
All right. Bob, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Elna in Madison. Hi.
Oh, good morning. I was just working on my taxes. I have a question about Wisconsin taxes also. There's this new deduction for retirement income. That information comes to me on a 1099-R, and it's pretty clear that I can take off my pension. But the IRA distribution, the RMD, also comes on a 1099-R. Is that included in that retirement income subtraction?
The quick answer to your question is yes. Wisconsin this year instituted a deduction for retirement. You must be age 67 by the end of the year to qualify for it. It's $2,400 for each person, $4,800 on a joint return. And that encompasses all of your retirement income, that whether it's from a 401k, 403b, or from your own retirement savings. So that will be deductible. Obviously, you can't double dip if you were a Wisconsin educator or a Wisconsin person who's not already paying taxes on it. You're not going to get a second deduction. And then the other half of the story is that if you take this deduction, you do not get the credits that you would otherwise get. So it is a deduction or credits. For senior citizens, the most common credit that you get is the rent or property tax credit. It's a maximum of $300. You would be giving up that credit to take the deduction. So it's important to find out how much were your credits and how much is this deduction saving you. And pretty much an average thing is that it's a 5% rate, and so it's going to save you probably at its maximum about $1,200 on a single return or $2,400 on a joint return. So usually giving up the credits in place of the deduction is worthwhile.
Is there an income associated with that, a maximum income that you can't
use? I haven't found any maximum income with that. Unlike the federal deduction for the senior citizen, which clearly has an income limitation.
Okay. Elnu, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Hazel had emailed us about that. She tried it out, the Wisconsin Retirement Income Subtraction, and when she answered yes, her refund increased by more than $500. So she wonders if there's any negative implications with using this deduction and whether it would affect her 2026 return.
I would say no. My biggest concern is that you make sure that you're taking the deduction and not also taking credit.
Yeah.
And for certain people, for instance, Wisconsin has a wonderful property tax credit for a disabled vet or a survivor of a disabled vet, which reimburses or gives a credit for 100% of the property taxes. 100% of your property taxes generally is more than what you're going to get for the retirement deduction. So in that case, you need to be careful. If you're a very charitable person or have high Schedule A deductions, like your medical or your mortgage interest, and you're a senior citizen, those numbers together with your $300 property tax credit could be higher than the deduction. So it's something you have to weigh the benefits of and choose the right side.
Makes good sense. Let's turn to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hello.
Good morning. I have a really simple question. I use an accountant, and we're kind of like your standard, maybe upper middle class family. Our mortgage is basically paid off, but our accountant said that not a couple of years ago with the change in the tax code, we used to always itemize, but he said because of the increase in the standard deduction, we no longer benefited as from itemization. And I just wanted to know in your practice, if that's consistent with his opinion. I'm just curious. Thank you.
Sure. I think that's a wonderful question to ask. And when in 2017, when the Tax Act came out and increased standard deduction, it doubled it. And so right now for a single or for a married couple, you're looking at $31,000. That's a lot of things to itemize or a lot of a high number to come up with. Today, as the mortgages have increased and you've got a high-end person, you need to watch those things as well, or a very charitable person. But the norm is you don't itemize as much on Wisconsin as you used to. But keep in mind that even though you don't itemize on Wisconsin, if you have a higher end person, you could qualify for, if you don't itemize on federal, you could still qualify for the itemized deduction credit on Wisconsin. So I always tell people, do the same thing in terms of keeping track of things that you've always done, because there are certain pieces of those itemized deductions, whether you itemize or not, are always used. Wisconsin uses your health insurance premiums, your long-term care insurance premiums. Wisconsin uses your property taxes. Without needing to itemize, Wisconsin uses all of those. And if you are higher end and your standard deduction on Wisconsin is reduced, you may be able to get extra for your charitable contributions and your mortgage interest. So what he told you is correct. It is generally the case, but it's important to watch those things to get the most out of it that you can.
Yeah. Jim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Mary Malam, our guest today, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David Onash, Wabanon Tax Professionals. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking taxes today with Mary Malam from Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Later on in the show, we'll take a look at 12:30. We'll take a look at affordable housing and the need for more of it with Elmer Moore, who is CEO and executive director of WEDA. So looking forward to that, too. But right now, your tax questions at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's turn to Kim in Eau Claire. Kim, hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, guest. If I could have a follow-up after this. So last year we paid a tariff. And is there anything in the tax forms that would give us tax difference because we paid a tariff
on the business? Okay.
My answer would be no. As a personal level, excise taxes are not deductible. It would depend. It would depend on what kind of tax or what kind of business you're looking at. There are certain taxes that are different for individuals than businesses. So I hate to, without looking into it more and without knowing more about exactly what you're saying, the general public who is paying tariffs through higher prices are not going to get deductions. Businesses may, depending on how it's set up. So I would have to look at the exact situation and see where it fit in there.
Okay.
And you had a follow-up, Kim?
Yeah, I'm a veteran, and you talked about taxes. I'm 60% disabled. I thought you had to be 100% in order to get a tax relief on your home.
You are exactly right. It's 100% disability for the disabled vet and the survivor if that disabled vet died. So you're exactly right.
Kim, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Leslie in Madison, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment. I believe the tax lady might have misspoken. She said the Wisconsin subtraction for retirement income, if you're 67 or older, I think she said it was $2,400 for a single person and $4,800 for married, but it's $24,000 for
a single person.
And
you are exactly right.
It's
$24,000, and the $24,000 translates into $1,200 of tax benefits at 5%. So if I said $1,000, you're exactly right. It's $24,000 and $48,000.
Ah, Leslie, thanks for calling in. Appreciate it. Mark in Wisconsin Dells, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I'm driving, but I'm driving hands-free, so I hope I don't get too distracted. My wife and I are both retired. We're over 65. We're both retired teachers, and basically my question is I'm going to try to do taxes on my own this year, and I have a 1099 miscellaneous form. Where do I claim that? Now, this 1099 miscellaneous is income for renting my agricultural tillable land.
Farmland.
Farmland, correct. Do I have to fill out the F form for farmers to claim that, or I guess that's the question.
Yeah.
All right. Good question. The land rental could go in one of two places. It is either a Schedule E, where rental property goes, or it would go on a Form 4835, which is for farmland rental. It would go on the 4835 if you have a say in the crops that are planted. So it does not go on the Schedule F. If you are just saying, the farmer comes to you and says, I want to rent your land and I'm going to plant crops, and you say, okay, collect the rent, it goes on Schedule E. If you and the farmer get together and decide how your what's being rented and maybe even you're paid in crops, that would be a 4835.
All right. Pretty straightforward. Thank you very much, Mark, for calling. And on to Dan in Madison. Your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I have a question on what to do with the beneficiary share of income on the form 2K1.
Okay.
How's that handled?
If you are the beneficiary of an estate or a trust and you receive a K1, there are two pieces to it. The 2K1 you're referring to is the Wisconsin part of it, but there is a federal K1 that matches that. And the pieces of that K1 tell you where they go. The K1 is divided by income, and it's separately stated income. So if the estate runs a business, line one is business income. If it has rental property, there is a place for rental. If it's sold property, it could have capital gain, might have interest or dividends. Those things all belong where they are on the tax return. The two part of it says if Wisconsin's treatment is different than federal, you might have an adjustment from what you put on the federal return to accommodate Wisconsin law.
And if you receive money from somebody dying, I thought that there was a maximum amount that, or a top dollar amount that you would receive without having to pay taxes on it. Am I confusing a couple of things here?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. First of all, inheritance is always an interesting topic. Generally, the word inheritance, if you inherit things, generally they're not taxable, except if you inherit money just flat out, or you are a person named in the will to get a certain dollar amount, that's not going to be taxable. When you inherit retirement programs that the decedent had not paid taxes on, the person who inherits those will pay taxes on it. Income in respect of a decedent. So it depends on where you're getting it from. If you inherit, the reason you have K-1 is the K-1 contains the income either earned after the person died or the income from the sale of property, or income from an activity that continues to go on after death. So what you're getting on the K-1 is not necessarily what you inherited on the day they died, but what comes as a result of some of that inheritance. Or in the case of income in respect of a decedent, there are certain kinds of things that would pay taxes on because the decedent would have paid taxes on them.
Makes perfect sense. Thank you very much for that explanation. And Dan, thank you for calling. Lori in Belleville, we'll go to you. Hi, Lori.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're coming loud and clear.
Okay, here's my question. I am 67 and retired. My husband is 57 and not retired. We always file together with whatever new stuff's coming out this year, state and or federal, applying to me. Should we be filing separately?
My answer to that is generally no. Because Wisconsin is a community property or marital property state, all of the income that is marital income is put into a bucket and divided evenly between people. Now, there are exceptions to that rule. If you got married during the year, maybe there's a situation where filing separate on the premarital income versus the marital income might make sense. If your income is from inheritance and you have kept it separately, that might be a reason. Or if you signed a premarital agreement that says what's yours is yours and what's mine is mine, maybe filing separate returns would work then. But those are exceptions. Generally, you're in the same boat if you file separately because you're cutting the income in two. And there are certain benefits, especially federal-wise, that are not granted to married separate returns.
Okay. Lori, there you go. Sounds like separately is not maybe the way to go for you unless you meet those other circumstances that Mary was talking about. Thank you for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Bonnie in Wanakee emailed to say her daughter received a scholarship that was used for graduate school tuition and fees. She received a 1099 miscellaneous for the scholarship amount. How does she record the scholarship and paid expenses so that she doesn't get taxed on the scholarship?
That's interesting that the scholarship came out on a 1099. And I think you said miscellaneous?
Yeah, 1099 miscellaneous.
Here's the deal. Scholarship is not taxable to the extent that it's used for tuition and books. And oftentimes, the 1098-T, which tells us what the tuition paid to a school is, has the scholarship there. And when we go to claim the credit, we net the two. If the scholarship is larger than the tuition, the excess scholarship is a taxable event. I would be asking questions about why is it on a miscellaneous. It generally doesn't come that way. And my only concern is it something that is work-related and they've been paid for working rather than as a scholarship? So generally it's just netting the two. But anytime there's an IRS document, you have to account for that document on the tax return. Right. If it's legitimately a scholarship and not, in this case, a taxable issue, you're going to have to put that document into the tax return and take it out, avoid taxation on it.
Yeah, that's the first thing that came into my mind after many, many years of working with graduate students here at UW-Madison. Sometimes it's a pure scholarship and sometimes it's a, they call it a working scholarship, but it's really more of a paid job that you have to do in order to receive the money for it.
You're paid to do a job, and it's kind of under the scholarship guise. It's still a job, and the job would be taxable.
Yeah. Ed emailed to say he filed his deceased mother's final tax return before April 15th of 2023. He's confident that he filed her tax returns accurately and completely. He's now wondering whether he can dispose of all of her tax papers after April 15th of 2026. The I know what he's talking about here. I lost both my brothers last year. The papers take up a lot of storage space.
People are always very anxious to get rid of things. Statute of limitations says that you have to keep, that the government can come back on you to question something that's happened. Federal statute of limitations is 3 years after, it's June 1st of, well, destroying the returns is June 1st of the year, 3 years after the due date of the return. So if it was a 23 return, it was due in 24, and for federal purposes, you're looking at 2027. For state purposes, you need to tack on a year to that.
Okay.
That would be the earliest I would do it. And, of course, as I advise clients, your heirs get to do this, and they can have a bonfire when they reach that date.
Okay. There you go. I'm thinking about for my two brothers. Dave and Nina, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I have a question about deductibility of property taxes. With the new tax bill that was passed last year, is there increased deductibility, or what's the higher limit of deductibility of property taxes?
Okay. What I think you're talking about in the new bill, in the 2025 tax bill, is what we call the SALT limit. And the SALT limit says that there's a limit on the amount of income tax and property taxes that can be deducted on the Schedule A. That SALT limit, created by the 2017 Act, was $10,000. The SALT limit was raised by the latest tax bill up to $40,000. And so that would say if you're paying $20,000 in property tax, for Schedule A purposes, you could deduct it all, where you would only have been able to deduct 10 of it in a prior year. Now, again, that encompasses all of your state taxes and theoretically foreign taxes that you're paying when we're talking about that, and skip the foreign because there's a different rule for that. But your property taxes and your income tax, those all go together, and currently you could have up to $40,000 of that on a Schedule A and be able to deduct it all.
Hmm. There you go, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. Beth in Cottage Grove emailed wondering how much money can she gift her child and her husband without creating a tax for them?
Okay. Gifting is an interesting thing. And gifting does not cause anybody any taxes unless you have, in this current year, made gifts of over 15, cumulatively made gifts of over $15 million. Now, that being said, gifting does require a reporting of the gift. And when people ask, how much can I gift? It's really the question should be, how much can I gift before I have to report that gift on a Form 709? The answer to that question for anyone other than the spouse is $19,000 currently. You can gift up to $19,000 without having to report it on a form. If you gift over $19,000, and that's cumulative gifts during the year, it's not just a one-time gift, but it encompasses everything you've given that person during the year. If it comes to over $19,000, you have to fill out a Form 709. The spouse is special, and there is an unlimited ability to gift to the spouse, unless that spouse is not a U.S. citizen. Then there is a dollar limitation. It's somewhere over $100,000 a year, somewhere in that range. Now, the other gifting thing that you need to be careful of is that if you set up a trust and irrevocably put things into a trust, that is a gift to beneficiaries of the trust. And that gift has to be reported up to any time because it's a gift of future interest. So there is no exclusion on that reporting. Well, how's that for lots of rules?
I knew there'd be a different rule between the child and the husband, or at least I guess there would be, for sure. Oh, man. Charlie in Sedona, Arizona. Your turn. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning.
Morning.
What can I have a resource to offer your listeners. Recently, my accountant and tax preparer retired. Suddenly, I had to look for an alternative, and I was referred to AARP, and with ease was able to find the AARP volunteers in tax preparation and where they were located. They are throughout the country, often setting up in public libraries, and on Saturday, my wife and I went there, and we received excellent services. So, for no charge at all, and they would not accept any kind of payment or gratuity, able, qualified, certified, experienced volunteers will help you prepare taxes. It takes several hours, and you do have to prepare materials for them, just as you might have done for an accountant in the past. But you do your best, and they will help you if you have difficulties even in doing the spade work to get the materials together.
Yeah. Charlie, thanks. Mary, I don't know if you're familiar with AARP's system or not.
Here's what I know. I believe those kind of programs, and the government also provides a program called VITA. And there are people that are available to help you prepare returns or prepare them for you. I believe there is an income limitation or at the very least a type of returns that they can and can't do. So if you have things like stock sales, they may not be able to do that. If you have a business or if you have a Schedule E, they may not be able to do that. But it certainly is a resource that you certainly should look into. Both AARP and VITA are served by volunteers.
Charlie, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Mary Mellum about your taxes, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. You could email the talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Hi there. I missed the beginning of the show where I assume you talked about this already, but we already sent our state taxes in, and we both qualify for the senior. We're both past 67 on retirement income, and we did not take the deduction. I'm not really sure how we missed it, but what should I do now that we've already sent it in?
You need to file an amended tax return for it. And a Wisconsin amended tax return, I don't know how you filed it, whether you did it yourself or did it through, you know, mailed it in or did it through Wisconsin's website or however you did it. You need to do an amended tax return. And Wisconsin's amend looks exactly like its regular form, and there is a special box that says this is an amended return. You will also need an SB schedule if you didn't use one already for some other purpose.
Okay, so straightforward as that. Thank you very much, Renee, for calling. Philip in Madison, your turn. Hi, Philip.
Hi. So we have a summer cabin that we've rented out over the years, and so we reported it as such, and we've depreciated it, and now we're getting ready to sell it, so I have to figure out the cost basis. some years it rented quite a bit, and some years it rented less than 14 days. Do I count depreciation in the years that it was rented less than 14 days?
Did you take depreciation in the years that it was rented less than 14 days?
The tax software that we used did not give me the option of filling out a Schedule E, so I don't believe that it was taken in those years.
Okay.
That's sort of one of the black boxes of the software, right? So,
if it is a rental property, a regular rental, which means that you used it for less than 14 days for personal purposes, then the depreciation is required in those days, whether you took it or not. If it is a vacation rental where you used it more than 14 days and no loss was allowed, you may or may not have had depreciation that you qualified for in those years. So you kind of have to look back at the history of what you did get benefit of or what you were allowed to have benefit of for that time. And that does reduce your basis for all those years.
Oh, okay. Philip, that help?
Yeah, that helps. So if we used it more than 14 but rented it less than 14 and we were not allowed to use Schedule E or deduct anything, then we would not have had depreciation in those years. Is that sound accurate?
The rules for a vacation rental say you can't take a loss. So if you collected $10,000 of rent and your expenses for property taxes, mortgage, and other regular expenses only came to $9,000, you'd still have $1,000 worth of depreciation that you would have been allowed in that year. So you have to look at what happened in that year specifically.
Yeah,
a vacation rental is, when it says you used it more than 14 days, that doesn't mean a Schedule E wouldn't have been allowed or shouldn't have been allowed. It just meant it's a vacation rental, you have to pick up the income, and you're allowed enough deductions to offset that income. They could be depreciation, but it's the third level down. So
yeah,
they never get to it. It just depends on your situation.
Yeah. Philip, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Linda emailed to say her sister passed away in October of 2024. Linda's the personal representative for the estate, and her two children in their early 20s are her sister's beneficiaries. Linda's received a 1099 DIV from one of her sister's funds, and Linda wonders if she needs to file personal taxes in her sister's name for this fund, or is it small enough to not have to file?
Okay. First of all, if Linda's a personal representative for her deceased sister, who died in 24, her deceased sister's final return should have been the 24 tax return. If there are still assets that are in her sister's name that have not been distributed to anyone, they are part of an estate, and an estate files a Form 1041. And so depending on what else is going on in the situation, that dividend statement technically belongs on the Form 1041.
Okay. Bob emailed to say he's been helping his elderly parents file their 1040 electronically for the last few years. This past year, they filed the IRS form to allow Bob to sign the return for them. Bob has received a CAF or CAF number from the IRS for that purpose. How does he sign their return for them and enter the CAF number electronically? The only extra signature spaces on the return are for a paid service filer or a third-party contact to discuss the return with the IRS.
As the personal representative, or in this case, power of attorney, he would be signing in their normal spot where the taxpayer would sign. He would sign his name as power of attorney.
Yep, name and POA at the end of it or something.
Yes. Yeah. And if there's room to put his CAF number in there, he could put it in there, but likely that's something that they would ask if they challenged it. And if there is the ability to attach that power of attorney document to the tax return, that's also a good idea.
Sally in Ironwood, Michigan, called to ask if there's anything new regarding inheritance taxes.
The inheritance tax, the thing that was included in the bill, is that the exemption amount or the exclusion amount is at $15 million. It was set to go back to pre-2017 levels had this not been included, and that would have dropped the exclusion amount to somewhere around $5 million.
Donna emailed to say she's a widow of a Vietnam vet who had a 100% disability rating. She is able to continue claiming the state property tax credit. If she remarries and purchases a home with her new spouse, will Donna lose that credit?
I'm not exactly sure of that, but my feeling would be yes, that it is tied to the fact that she is the widow or the surviving spouse of a deceased person. She would be married to someone new. So I would do some research on it, but my feeling is that it would go away if she remarries.
Steve in Stoughton, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Larry and Mary. Thank you again for all your help, Mary, in understanding these complicated issues. My father-in-law passed away in February. He was living in Illinois. My wife is dealing with the trust. We are trying to discern, and it's confusing, the tax implications of the estate versus inheritance. And if you could help out understanding what estate means versus inheritance means.
Okay. And you mentioned the word trust, so help me out here. Did his father have, or did your father-in-law have a living trust?
Yes.
Okay. So the living trust is kind of like a will, and it kind of like says, while I'm alive, I get to do with whatever I put into this trust, but when I die, it's set in cement. And that trust document tells you what happens. And it's like a will. It avoids probate. So with a trust document, you don't have to go to the court and fill out probate papers and things like that. But you do have to abide by the requirements of the trust. Because it's a living trust, it acts very much like an estate in the sense that when a person dies, the property that is in a living trust, in other words, a revocable trust, is revalued at the date of death. That's the way it happens with an estate. So from that point, inheritance comes. If the trust says that all my property goes to my daughter, then all the property valued at that date, and that becomes cost basis of the property that the daughter receives.
And at that point, we've got to take a quick break for the news. We'll be back with Mary right after the news. Talking taxes on the program today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, back with us. She and her husband, David, have been in the business for more than 30 years. They operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. We have callers online. Did you have any more comments for Steve as we rolled out of that last half-hour segment.
The only last thing that I would say is, if Dad set up a trust and put everything in the trust, it's the trust vehicle that they're going to deal with. But if some of the accounts didn't go into the trust, then there could be an estate as well as a trust. They function similarly, but then are two separate things that could cause income if it wasn't distributed, K-1s that we talked about before. That's about all that I have to say. I recommend that seek some professional advice in that.
Yeah. Cheryl in Colby, we'll go to you now. Hi, Cheryl.
Good afternoon. In January of 2025, my house burned down and was a total loss. The insurance company paid out for that loss, and also they paid out for personal possessions at the actual cash value. Do I have any tax responsibility for either of those payouts?
In the case of insurance, if you got more than it was worth, the answer, well, more than your cost basis in it, the answer is yes, you could have some. Did you replace your home? Because
no.
Okay. Then you need to look at, if you didn't replace your home, replacement says insurance company pays you out, you take the money, you buy a new home within the two-year period and replace it, there's no problem. If you don't replace it, then it's like a sale and you need to compare the cost basis that you had in the property to what they gave you, and you could have some income tax consequences as a result of that.
Cheryl, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. So she needs to figure that cost basis out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the form, there is a casualty loss form that figure it out on, and that would show you that if you got reimbursed more than your cost in the property and you didn't replace it, you would have some gain.
Cheryl, good luck, and thank you for calling. And I'm sorry your house burned down, for sure. Joe in Madison, we go to you now. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I am the full-time employee of a corporation. I am also the CEO of a startup, so it's a Delaware-registered C Corp, where all the shares now are in my name. Recently, I've had someone suggest that I could take some of the income from, let's call it my day job, and do a loan to my startup C Corp, with the impact being it would reduce my, let's call it, full-time job tax liability. At this point, I just want to know, is that something to pursue further? Because there is some kind of a mechanism that will allow that to happen.
Okay. Is your startup producing any income at this point?
It is not.
Okay. Have you actually opened the door? Do you have a product to sell, or are you still just in the, I guess, for lack of a better word, startup process?
I have opened the door to pre-sales and accepting deposits. So far, I think I've had two deposits of $100 that would represent $2,000 of revenue, but that's the extent so far.
Okay. In what you're describing, I don't see any way that you could reduce your employee day job income. You can lend money to a startup. The loan depends. Is your startup, is it a Schedule C business? Have you done anything else in that light?
It is a Delaware registered C Corp that has an EIN.
Okay, so it is a C Corp, not, and I excuse me, because you did say that. If it's a C Corp, you could loan money to your corporation. The loan itself is not going to reduce your income. And, you know, the loan would create a deduction paying you interest. So if someone is telling you something, it's not something my mind is wrapping itself around. You can lend money to it, but that should create income to you and a deduction to the corporation. I don't see how that would take your day job income down at all.
Hmm. All right. Joe, there you go. Jeff emailed to ask if he only has Social Security income for income, is it worthwhile to file for a homestead exemption?
Good question. First of all, if you only have Social Security, you have no tax on the federal side. You could qualify for a homestead credit if you're paying property, if you have property taxes or paying rent. Your income has to be below $24,000. I think it's $24,600. You can look at the exact number. But that does include your Social Security income. So if all your income is Social Security, it has to be under that $24,000 figure for you to qualify for homestead to begin with. And then it's a combination of what your income is versus what the rent you pay or the property taxes to see if there is anything to get back. It's certainly worth trying it if your income is below that $24,000 figure. And again, homestead encompasses all of your household income, not just what shows up on an income tax return.
Let's turn to Shelley in Green Bay next. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Okay. So my father passed away in February of last year. In the past put the name, the children's names, my siblings and I, his house. Now I need to file taxes and need to know how I need to put this in my tax form.
So,
okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So are you talking about the house itself?
Yes, the house and the land it was on.
Is that house a rental property or did your dad live there?
My dad lived there.
Okay. And sometime before he died, he put your names on the house in place of his or together with his?
In place of his.
Okay. If he did it correctly, you would have inherited the house. Was the house sold?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's one of two situations that happen. Either if he gifted you the house before he died, then your cost basis for the sale of that house is whatever he had invested in that house. If he gifted the property with a retained life estate, which means that I'm going to give you this property, you don't get it till I die, I'm going to pay the property taxes, you can't get me out. If that was the written or even implied understanding, then when he died, you inherited that house, and the house had a new cost at his death, whatever the value was at his death. So you have to ask yourself which way that is. If he did it the latter way, where it was a gift with a retained life estate, it means that your cost basis is whatever it was worth when he died, and your gain on the sale is probably much smaller than if he had gifted it outright to you before. Does that make any sense?
Does that help, Shelley?
That helps. I know what he paid for the improvements that he made on it. And basically, I was told that we would take that amount divided by six.
Did your dad pay the property taxes on the house while he was living there? Or did you kids do that?
Nope, he did that.
Okay. If anything went wrong with the house, who fixed it?
Dad.
Okay.
Then you're in a much better position, I think.
Chances are you have a case for an implied life estate if nothing was done. And if that was the case, you need to find out what the value of the house was on the day he died. I would check with a real estate person, an appraiser, whatever. That would be to your tax advantage if that were the situation.
Much to your advantage, likely.
And to ask, to go back to your question, you reported on a Schedule D, 8949 technically, and whatever the property, your share of whatever the property sold for compared to the cost basis. It's the cost basis that you have to decide which situation applies to you, whether he had retained the right to live there in giving up his ownership, or if he just flat out gave it to you, because there will be a difference tax-wise.
Shelley, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mike emailed to say that in 2025 he received shares of Capital One stock after their purchase of Discover Financial Services and a $30 payment in lieu of a fractional share. Does Mike need to report the $30 payment on Schedule D, or is there a shortcut method on the 1040? The Discover stock was acquired in 2007.
If the Discover stock, I forget what he said he got in place of it.
Oh, it was it was after the purchase of Discover Financial Services. It was Capital One stock after their purchase of Discover Financial.
If he got money out of the transaction, the cash is taxable in the year that he got it. And then his stock, the Capital One stock, would have a basis that was contingent on sharing the Discovery stock. It's a formula you have to go through. But his question is the $30 that he got in cash taxable? And that's yes, and it does belong on a 1099. It belongs on the 8949, which goes to the Schedule D.
Okay. All right. There we go. Julie in Glenwood City, it's your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Say, my father died in January, and I am the trustee of his trust. And it's to be divided into four parts, and two of them were trusts that were set out in his original trust documents. They were for two of my brothers. Oh, and I'm trying to establish, and I've got the EIN numbers for both of those trusts. Now, when I'm trying to establish the trust accounts with the investment firm, they're telling me that I need new trust documents for those two trusts and the date that they were established. Now, the attorney that wrote the trust doc, the original trust, he says that it's already stated in the original trust of my father's. Which is true?
Oh, I'm sorry, Julie. I can't help you with that. I'm not a lawyer, so if I assume you said four parts, and in the trust, two individuals got half of it, and two trusts were set up, maybe disability trust or whatever, that were supposed to get the rest of it. If they were set up and not funded at that problem part, the IRS probably still recognizes those numbers, but I think you need another attorney's advice in that. What you're describing sounds legitimate. I'm not sure why another trust would have to be set up, but there could be something on the legal side that I don't know.
Yeah. Julie, good luck, and thank you for calling. Jim in Boston emailed to say he and his partner filed jointly. They are ages 70 and 73, and Jim is the sole proprietor with no employees. Jim has higher loss amounts versus profits. So can they both file 1099 SR forms? If not, what forms are needed?
Okay. I guess I'm a little confused. When he uses the term partner, are we talking about a partnership or are we talking about a marriage?
And I don't know that from looking at it.
Where the question is going. The 1040 SR is used in the very same way that a 1040 form is. It's just bigger print, easier to read, but you attach the same forms to it that you do to a regular 1040. So I don't know if that's the direction of the question. If they're partners, I'm not sure if there is a marriage here. If it's a marriage, you know, if we're talking individuals and partner means that they're married and it's a joint return versus a separate return, then we get into the community property stuff and the higher losses on one versus the other probably isn't going to make any difference. So I'm not sure I've answered the question because I'm not sure what the question really is.
Yeah, I'm sorry I don't have that. I think it's implied that it feels to me like looking at the words that they're married, but because he lists the ages as 70 and 73.
They're married, then we've got the community property issues. And like we talked about before, if it's community income and there is no premarital agreement, what one is has higher or lower than the other really isn't going to matter.
Yeah. Andy emailed to ask what mistakes are made by those of us who self-prepare our own taxes, like deductions or credits that may be missed. Andy feels his taxes are simple enough with interest, dividends, capital gains, and a $2,200 federal credit for the child. He often wonders if he's only missing out of anything, as tax software seems so easy, needing only to plug in the numbers.
Well, here's a little bit of advice for Andy. We advise that if you're going to do your own return, and that doesn't mean people aren't capable of doing your own returns. It means that you're willing to sit down and spend a lot of time looking at the updates and knowing what's going on. But you may want to invest in a tax professional once every 3 years. And I say 3 years because if you've done it and missed things, in a three-year period, you have time to go back and amend the prior years. So from that standpoint, you might want to let someone take a look at it, see if you've missed out on things, and you have an opportunity to catch up on them. You can't really describe what could be missed because he said one thing about a child. With a child, there could be tax benefits like EIC and child care credit and child tax credit and things like that. With an adult, you know, a senior citizen, it could be the deductions that we've been talking about. So it all depends on the situation.
Connie emailed to say her husband passed away last summer. Since then, Connie hasn't been able to pull the correct papers together or gone to probate court to settle the estate. Can Connie access any amount that might be in his IRA to pay for what she needs to get done?
Well, it depends. That's a good question. The probate and the IRA are generally two separate things. If the IRA had a separate beneficiary on it, if Connie is the beneficiary of the IRA and not the estate, the beneficiary of the IRA, she could get into that all by itself. If the estate beneficiary of the IRA, then she's got to go and be recognized as the personal representative, or whoever is the personal representative would have control to take money out of that IRA.
John emailed to say they have been living out of the country for 3 years, the past 3 years. John's yearly income is below $13,000. He hasn't filed a tax return since living in the country. Does he still need to file a return? If not, how much does one need to make to be required to file a return?
That's a wonderful question. If you are a U.S. citizen and have retained your U.S. citizenship, you are taxable on your worldwide income. Now, if his worldwide income is, as a single person, below $15,750, $17,750 as someone over 65, he would not be required to file a tax return. Married couples, those numbers jump to $31,500, and depending on whether you're over 65 or not, they would be higher. But again, it's worldwide income, not just U.S. income. And if you're below, if your worldwide income is below that amount, you have no requirement to file a tax return. If it is over that amount, then you do, no matter where you're living.
Mary, it is a pleasure talking with you. You've done a marvelous job, as always, answering these questions, and I hope we can do this again. Thank you, Mary.
You're welcome, Larry.
It's been a real pleasure. Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She does such a good job. I'm always amazed at how much she knows about taxes. It's just great. Coming up, we're going to take a look at affordable housing in Wisconsin. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.